Hello, I'm Andrew Scrivani.
And I'm Chef John. Welcome to the Chef John Podcast.
Welcome back. Welcome back to the Chef John Podcast. I am feeling so festive today. I am feeling so festive because this is our holiday show. John, welcome to the holiday show.
Hey there, Andrew. Yeah, only, what is it, like a week before Christmas?
Yeah, we still got some shopping days. We're okay. We're still like, you know, we got a couple of days in there. We have, you know, 70 or 80 more repetitions of White Christmas on XM radio.
Which after enough Christmas carols becomes SM radio.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that was the fortunate slip of the tongue.
A Freudian Christmas slip. Are you a brick and mortars guy? Are you actually shopping in a store?
There are things that I prefer to get in stores. I do enjoy a little bit of online shopping, makes things easier. I do give people a lot of tickets to things. That's been my sort of go-to. I'm like uncle baseball game. Like I will give tickets to baseball, basketball, football game. That's been my sort of easy out with my nieces and nephews.
And let me guess, you give them two, knowing they don't have any other friends that will go with them.
That's right. And then I get to go to the game. So it's sort of, I'm buying myself a present.
Very smart.
You know, John, speaking of presents and gift giving at the holidays, and you just referenced it a little bit. Sometimes, you know, gift giving can be a little bit self-serving because, you know, you're giving a gift that you think may include you in some way, shape, or form. there's one particular type of gift giving for people like you and I that I feel is very much the double-edged sword of gift giving and a little bit self-serving. And that's when we give people who do not have quality cookware in their kitchen some things that may help the next time we're over cooking a meal. So I know that you probably have that experience too, because I know I have.
Yeah, you just reminded me of a classic Christmas tale from many years ago. As you know, I used to fly back to see my mom and family usually twice a year, once a year minimum, twice a year, hopefully. And every single time I would go back, we would do obviously a ton of cooking. It's like all we do.
Yep.
And every year I would say the same thing. Ma, how can you use that bent, melted spatula? I was going to say rubber spatula, but it wasn't even rubber. They used to make them with plastic.
That's right.
The kind of plastic with the, you know, the fumes coming off it that can kill a mouse in a lab in like 4 minutes. So anyway, every time go home, do all this cooking, amazing food, great times. But the one downside was using subpar is not, it doesn't even describe it. Like her main knife to cut things was like an extra large odd steak knife, like from an old set that was just bigger than the other. She used to do that, like tomatoes, mirepoix, like no matter what you're boning out of chicken. Well, she didn't really do that, but you know, pretty much anything, these two or three super dull, just not appropriate knives were used. So of course I get stuck using the same thing. And every year after getting frustrated after a few days, I'd say, you know what, let's just go to the store, get a few things. And you know how mom, you know, no, you're not buying me that. I'm fine. You use your fancy stuff when you get back. I like this. So it was always no. So one year I decide better to ask forgiveness than permission. I decide I'm going to just for Christmas give her a little sort of gift basket of hand tools, a couple pots, a couple pans, just something to get us up into this century technology cooking wise. So I do. And it wasn't extravagant, just an actual spatula, like a handle that won't melt and a silicone head on it, you know, and an actual whisk, not whatever she was using. I think was like a long fork, like just some basic stuff. Couple stainless steel bowls, sheet pan that wasn't bent, that didn't have 75 nicks and dents in it. So give it to her. Oh my God, thank you so much. You shouldn't have. Oh my God, I'm so pissed. Anyway, thank you so much. So fly back to San Francisco. Not sure how many months it was before my next return visit.
Well, they only allow you to do horse tranquilizer twice a year. So that's right. To get you on a plane. So
anyway, whenever it was, I fly back and we're going to make something. And I go into the kitchen and I don't see any of the tools that were that were given to her. She got the same cutting board out that I think was made of like this glass material. Like it was the weirdest thing. She used to cut on this glass cutting board.
Oh, my mom had one of those. It sounds like nails on the chalkboard. It's horrible.
There's nothing worse. And you know, she'd making me my favorite. She always made me potato salad when I would come home. Mm-hmm. That was apparently my baby food. That was the first like adult food I ever ate. I couldn't get enough of it. That I was raised on potato salad. So she would always make potato salad. It would always like be either done or in progress when I got home from the airport. So, you know, I walk and there she is, same old dented, scratched steak knife, cutting up those potatoes and the same stained like Tupperware plastic bowl and the, you know, everything that I didn't. And so the stuff, she didn't throw it away. It was right. It was all there. I looked in the cupboards and, you know, but just, I guess after a certain number of years, you just don't want to use different hand tools and equipment and utensils and pots and pans that you're not used to. So it's muscle memory or superstition or just it's always worked. If it's not broken, don't fix it. So anyway, I gave up at that point. I don't know how many years ago that was. I gave up trying to get her to use any kind of nice tools. And I started to do what I think you do when you travel. I would just tuck a few knives into the suitcase, maybe a thermometer, you know, probe thermometer,
yep,
a whisk, a pair of tongs. The tongs she used were like the kind that had the loops on the end.
Yeah, yeah. My mom had those too. It was like a scissors.
Yeah, they look like scissors with two little round.
Yeah, yeah.
You couldn't grab anything. You might as well have just not grabbed it. I would bring my restaurant line cook tongs. Like, what are those? Yeah. So, you know, and it was that kind of the stuff, that kind of stuff that drives you crazy. Cause it's like, this is so far superior and probably the same price, if not cheaper. Why are we using the scissor tong things that no one even knows the name of? Cause it's not even a real tool. So anyway, that's my Christmas traveling using bad utensils story. I finally sort of broke down and figured I was just doing the best thing ever. She was going to be so happy and would use those newfangled whisks and spatulas. Whenever she reached, she'd go right past the nice one and grab that same old spoon that she'd been using for who knows how many decades.
Well, you know, there is that thing about, you know, being used to doing the things the way you always done them, but also the idea that maybe you're afraid the food isn't going to taste the same if you change something, right? You know, that all of that, you know, melting plastic off that spatula, that probably was the secret ingredient in some of that stuff.
Well, you've heard the Southern cooks, which I still have not confirmed this, if this is a real thing, that the cast iron pans they use for the fried chicken and the hush puppies, that it just won't taste the same in a new pan. Since they never really wash them, they just kind of rub them out and just you know, add new oil. And they've been doing that for decades. I mean, can a pan actually absorb and transfer flavor? Do we need to ask our viewers?
I think we do. I think we need to get a definitive crowdsourced answer on that.
That's right. So hit us up on what are all the venues?
Well, there is thechefjohnpodcast.com. There is @chefjohnpod on Twitter and Instagram. So those are the places we will primarily be able to interface with you. And of course, if you're on our website, you can call us on the hotline and leave a message.
So I need verification. Can a cast iron pan absorb flavor? And do old ones taste better than new ones? And also, does your mom use really, really bad utensils? And is it frustrating for you?
Yes, we're here for you. Speaking of what you referenced earlier, John, about me traveling with my knives and kitchen tools everywhere I go, and being that I'm not a chef, yet I still am expected to cook for people wherever I land, I did start to bring those things with me because if I was traveling and I was staying at an Airbnb or staying at someone else's house who's not necessarily a cook, this became the thing that enraged me. it became crazy that I would have to risk being arrested at airports carrying very sharp instruments just because if I had to cut a tomato, I just couldn't bear to do it.
First of all, wearing them in your belt probably was not the best move.
I know, but they look really cool.
It's a bad look at the airport. So once you started putting them in your suitcase, I'm sure it was a little smoother.
Yeah, it was better. And then, of course, I had to start checking my luggage, which is then a big pain in the neck, right? Because now I have knives in my bag. I have to check the luggage. So, but I was wondering, you know, like, how does that make you feel, John?
How does what make me feel?
The fact that when you go places that you are expected to cook, they do not have what you need.
Oh, it's troublesome. But it's more of an internal battle. I try to keep a poker face.
Mm.
I joke about being a prima donna, but I try to pretend I can use anything. See, you said something a little while ago that, you know, it's questionable. I'm not a chef. You know, I have a very loose definition. But as you may know, chefs assume we can do anything because like that job's so hard and you have to have so many different skills. You just assume like, oh, fly a plane. How hard can it be? Where's the manual? And what do you mean pay someone to plumb the toilet? It's a couple of pipes. So you just screw it in. We got to get the right size screwy things, whatever those are called. It is very frustrating internally when you show up at like the timeshare and they have so much equipment. That's my thing about timeshares. They always have a ton of stuff, but none of it is anything you want. It's like they'll have seven bowls. They're like cereal bowl. Like you can't mix anything in. And then like a giant bowl, but no, like, can I just get a 12 inch bowl? So it's always like Murphy's Law. They'll have tons of equipment, but never the stuff you want. And then yes, you have to try to cook and do your dish and your, the entire time you're doing it, you're thinking, oh, you know what I need is I don't have that. And you're trying to, you know, you're trying to strain things through holes poked in tinfoil. Oh my God, I just aged myself. Aluminum foil. If someone says tinfoil, they're over 50. So yes, that is always very frustrating. I don't know if this counts as what drives Chef John crazy, but the inadequate tool set at an away game, as we'll say.
Yes.
Cooking in a strange kitchen.
Yep.
Very frustrating. Makes you crazy, but you have to keep your composure because after all, we are chefs.
Yes, because chefs are known for keeping their composure.
Yes, exactly. We should be able to do it no matter what the equipment. So, you know, you smile, you grin, you bear it. But absolutely, if you're used to using really nice tools, really nice pans, really nice pots, and by the way, a nice gas range, timeshares tend to have, and my mom had the absolute worst electric stove in history with like, you know, those, my college dorm room hot plate coil was better than my mom, like the best burner on my mom's stove. That's the stuff that really, when you travel, makes you crazy. And maybe I kept my cool and didn't show it too much, but now that might be wishful thinking. I probably was just like, why are his hands clenched? His knuckles are white on that whisk. Oh, that's not a whisk. That's why.
You know what tool every timeshare and Airbnb has in abundance?
What's that?
Corkscrews. You're looking for a knife. You're looking for something. And then you open this drawer and it's filled with corkscrews because everybody who goes on vacation brings their own corkscrew for fear that there won't be a corkscrew at the Airbnb.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Yeah, that's true. And then, you know, the knives are always the, you know, the Ginsu. They thought they looked good. It looked good in the infomercial, but they're just always really terrible knives.
Or IKEA, lots of IKEA.
Yeah, and they're always generally serrated. Like, I don't know where people got the idea that all knives should have a serrated edge, which is the opposite generally of knives chef use. It's almost all straight edges, except you want a couple serrated, of course.
Just the bread knife.
Yeah, but the timeshare knives are always serrated. But in fairness, the faux wooden handles can be quite comfortable.
Okay. Well, then I think that, you know, if you are going to give a gift this holiday season and it is going to be in the cookware, you know, arena, and it may be for somebody who doesn't necessarily have that kind of acumen in the kitchen, buy something you like.
Because they're not going to use it anyway, probably.
Yeah, exactly. John, all this talk of Airbnbs and being in other people's homes. And it reminds me that, you know, the holidays are a really big time for traveling, and that, you know, getting to our destination for that big meal and making sure that, you know, we're there for the celebration is, you know, is really primary for a lot of people. It's very stressful. And, luckily I've spent most of my, you know, holidays in New York with my family who are all here. So I didn't have to do a lot of holiday traveling, but there has been a few occasions where I've had to. And but you, on the other hand, need to go across the country if you want to spend it with your closest loved ones.
Yes.
I know you have a few experiences traveling during the holidays that have been a little bit stressful.
Very stressful. Most of the stress comes from just terrified of flying. But above and beyond that, I would usually almost always have to work pretty much right up to the day before Christmas Eve, generally. Sometimes I even worked early in the day on Christmas Eve and then would take off, which was problematic because our huge family events for Christmas were my Uncle Bill and Aunt Angela and family would cook an amazing feast that we would start eating after midnight mass.
Okay. Yeah, sure.
And then Christmas Day was the traditional dinner with the homemade pasta or homemades, as they were called. And then the roast chicken, sometimes you cook goat, like there was all kinds of just amazing stuff. So that was always the stress was getting there on time for that.
Sure.
You know, with the weather and you just never knew. And I remember one year waiting for the plane at SFO. And this is it's the night before Christmas Eve.
Okay.
I needed to get there by Christmas Eve. That was the big thing.
So the 23rd, right.
Okay. The 23rd. But it's, you know, it's going to be a red eye. So I'm not going to get in until Christmas Eve, New York time.
Right. In the morning. Right.
Late morning. Anyway, the plane, I have a seat. I'm good. But apparently the plane, this one particular flight, was horribly overbooked and they were desperate to get people to give up their seats. I'm not sure exactly what happened. And you know, back in the day, they used to offer, you know, a couple $100 if you would take the next flight.
Yep.
Or they put you up in a nice hotel. I mean, different deals depending on how desperate they were. So I remember hearing the announcement, you know, ladies and gentlemen, if you're able to adjust your traveling and would like to give up your seat, we have a, you know, $75 credit and we'll put you up at the blah, blah, blah hotel here and you can go out tomorrow evening and whatever the case was. And not interested, not worth it. Got to see the family. They'll be hugely disappointed if I'm not there for all the festivities. And then the offers kept getting sweeter. And I think they finally topped out at $300 and a night in a hotel to fly the next night, a red eye the next day.
Okay.
Of course, this means I might probably miss the festivities on Christmas Eve.
Right.
And I'm thinking, now personally, I'm thinking, man, I would love to make $300.
Yeah.
Crash a hotel room and fly in a day late, you know, but I can't do that to my family. Like what kind of person chooses money and, you know, 300 thread count sheets over their family at the holidays?
I don't know. Should I answer that question?
I'm in this tug of war. Like, do you take the money? They're going to be pissed. They're going to do what they got. Now, how badly will they think of you? Like, I'm trying to do the math.
Yeah.
The risk reward. Anyway, finally, at the last second, I'm like, you know what? I want to get there for Christmas Eve. I want to be there for all this amazing stuff. And I know my family would be horribly disappointed. And it's just not worth it. Like, what's, and by the way, back then, just dirt broke. So, like, that was a huge, tempting offer. But anyway, ultimately, I decide not to do that.
Okay. You were a good boy. You did
good boy. Right. Didn't want to disappoint everybody. Right. I knew they would be just hurt. And I didn't want them thinking, I was at whatever type of guy you were going to say. So, so the flight goes as well as can be expected. I do make it in, you know, late morning, early afternoon, back Christmas Eve, able to do So as I'm driving into town, I think my sister probably picked me up. I'm telling her this story and what a great son I was and what a great nephew. And I'm like, and my sister's like, what? Why wouldn't you have taken that money? I'm like, that's just you saying that. People would know I did the right thing. Anyway, so of course, go to midnight mass, show up at the big festivities, the big feast afterward. My sister's like, oh my God, tell them the story about the. So I recap the, and everyone to a person, every single relative. And now, you know, mind you, they're 2, 3, 4, 7 glasses of wine in at this point.
Sure.
They are just like, what the heck were you thinking? You could have just, we would have saw you a day late, big deal. We're not going anywhere. You could 300, how much? Like, it was basically, you stupid idiot. Why would you, not one person was like, you know, you made the right call. You can't put a price on being with your family, even if it's only 24-hour difference. So no, everybody was like, could not believe how dumb I was not to take the money in the hotel room and just come the next day.
You might have the only family in America that felt that way.
I don't know. I find that hard to believe. They seemed fairly typical. But anyway, I don't know. They were not impressed with my putting them ahead of $300 cash in a nice hotel room.
It just goes to show you, if you're planning a meal and you're inviting some of them, they might not show up till the next day.
If they have an opportunity to get bumped. Yeah.
They were hoping to get bumped.
Definitely not the reaction I was expecting of, oh my God, that's amazing. Well, you did the right thing.
Yeah.
Money is money, but you know, family's family. And you don't miss the feast of the, how many fishes is it? 7 fishes. So yeah, but apparently I made the wrong move.
I would love for the audience to tell us if you pulled that move.
Would your family appreciate it?
Yeah, I would love to know how many of you out there feel like John really did do the right thing and his family is a bit unique. Or
they're like, you could have taken that money and you could have bought the prime rib.
Exactly. So let's hear from you. I would love to have a Twitter conversation about this one. John, what conversation around the holiday season would two guys like us have if we didn't really talk about the things that we really love to eat around the holidays? I would love to have that conversation with you because I don't know that we've ever really discussed that before. Like, what are your favorite holiday dishes, the things that you only eat around the holidays?
Oh, okay. Well, mine is just a no-brainer.
Mashed potatoes. Oh, no, sorry.
No, well, I do. I would eat that. No, every year, about a month ahead of the holidays, ahead of Christmas, my Uncle Bill and his sons, Mike and Billy, would make this amazing sausage.
Hmm.
Fairly classic Italian, you know, dried fennel, orange zest, garlic, really, really good. And they would, grind all the meat themselves, put in the casing, and then he would hang it in his cellar, which always freaked me out as a kid before I went to culinary school. So that you could just hang meat.
Sure.
Because my mom was always like, close the refrigerator door, that meat's going to spoil. Like, you know, people had just crazy foodborne illness fears back then, like trichinosis. Oh God, that pork chop still got some liquid in it. So, you know, this was like a crazy new thing to me that you could hang meat in your cellar. But anyway, every year he would make a huge amount of this sausage. It would dry, not down to a salami, but it would dry pretty dry. And then on Christmas Eve, he'd have this big electric skillet he'd plug in and, you know, put it on kind of medium low and it would just slowly caramelize and he would brown it. And there would always be some Italian bread and pickled peppers and relishes that they jarred during the summer.
Yeah.
That was by far my favorite food Christmas memory. The Italian sausage Uncle Billy would make after midnight mass. I mean, my mouth waters just thinking about it. And then the years, you know, a few years I wasn't able to come back for Christmas. He would mail me, he would freeze a package and mail it out to me.
Nice.
And it would just be such a beautiful, you know, little taste of home, literally. When I think Christmas and food, that's the instant visual. And I mean, I can smell it, I can taste it, I can see it. Just those perfect little sausage frying in that pan, the aroma of that, you know, beautifully aged pork, like nothing smells like cured pork.
Yeah.
Can you smell umami? Like you probably can.
Yeah.
Just that gorgeous, gorgeous aroma, always seasoned perfectly. And just, it was just a, like food you can't get anywhere else anytime.
Yep.
That was the one time I was going to eat that. He could have gave that recipe to the top 50 chefs in the world. They could have made a batch. None of them would have come out like that.
Yeah, that's the really interesting, unique part about that kind of home cooking, especially like the ones that we were exposed to being in Italian families with the stuff that came from the old country and how they would do things. The visual you just created for me in my head is God, I wish I could photograph that basement with the hanging sausage. And that just sounds so visually arresting for me. It would be amazing. And that picture you painted about the smells too, like it's just, it is unique that we are connected to our food memories so strongly through smell, right? And that it really does register and bring back those really vibrant things that we had as children. And the holiday stuff, you know, because they made it so special, you know, yeah. The folks from the old country really did make it quite special around the holidays. They really were into it. And mine is this... it's connected to the Feast of the Seven Fishes, which is a very traditional sort of Christmas Eve meal of all seafood. My Aunt Chickie, of course, everyone in an Italian family had an Aunt Chickie, would do the frutta di mare. And oh God, it was unreplicatable. Just the seasonings and the, you know, it was just such a, the crunch of the celery that was in it. Like everything about it just, for me, reminded me of that time of year because it was the only time of year she would make it. She would make it that time once a year, seven fishes. That was one of the seven fishes, usually the first one we ate because it was more of an appetizer. And I've tried to make it. I've tried to recreate it. I don't have a recipe. I don't think any of those women cooked with recipes back then. I've tried to reverse engineer quite a bit of that food that I had from my grandparents and my aunts. But that seafood salad is not something that I've ever been able to replicate. It's burned and seared into my memory as part of that tradition. And it's something that I wish at some point, and I sample it pretty much everywhere I go, you know, like that has a, you know, a substantial kind of seafood menu in an Italian restaurant, but no one's ever gotten close. And I think maybe because it's so, those memories are so tinged with nostalgia.
Mm-hmm.
That I don't know that there's ever you can't put that ingredient.
Every once in a while, I'll get a request from someone that says, you know, I was in Paris on my honeymoon and we had these crepes from a streetcar. Oh man, could you do that recipe?
Right.
No, I cannot, because we're not in Paris and you're not just married.
Yeah, over the moon with love.
And there's so much above and beyond the actual taste and smell and texture of the food that goes into a dish. That's maybe 20% of it. It's the setting, it's the company, it's the lead up, it's the, you know, anticipation. You just can't recreate certain recipes.
No.
Can't recreate that moment in time.
That's right.
And if we could, and then we'd have something. You reminded me of something. Was one of your courses in the Feast of the Seven Fishes, a calamari pasta or spaghetti, like a like an angel hair with calamari sauce or something similar?
I think it was a shrimp sauce that we had.
My family did it was calamari tomato sauce, fairly straightforward. I think there was maybe raisins in it or currants.
Yeah, that's a very Sicilian thing, yeah.
And it was stewed for a really long time and then just tossed with some pasta. Just amazing stuff. And I remember that was one of the first, I wouldn't call it an argument, but one of the first debates I ever had with a chef at culinary school,
mm-hmm.
I remember in class, we were working with calamari and the chef said, the secret to calamari, there's only one way to cook it effectively. And that's for like maybe 15, 20 seconds in a really hot pan. Otherwise, it's inedible.
Hmm.
So he made his thing. That's pretty good. I said, but you know what? It's also really good if you cook it like for an hour and a half.
Right.
My family makes this tomato sauce and they cook the calamari, they simmer it for an hour and a half. And it is amazing. It just gets so tender. And he was just like, he apparently had never had that or heard, like he had one way he did calamari. And again, this is way before Instagram, Twitter, Food Network. He had never come across or had the occasion to enjoy super long, slow cooked calamari in a sauce. So he just was something that was foreign to him. But anyway, I remember saying like respectfully, like, you know, there's actually another way to cook calamari. And I know nothing. I just got here, but I know I've been eating this stuff like every year since I can remember, and it's really good and it's really tender. So yes, there's some truth to what he said. It's either 30 seconds or it's an hour and a half. You don't want to go 20 minutes on the calamari. Then you're talking rubber bands.
Yeah.
But anyway, so that I always flash back to that. It was like, I'm pretty sure I'm right here, but I don't know if I want to argue with him too much because he's grading the papers. But and he was a German chef who are known for their senses of humor.
Yes, of course.
So yeah, he would have laughed it up if I kept arguing. But anyway, I always remember that. The Feast of the Seven Fishes. They would do that, but then they always had the sausage in the background.
Do you like to do the big meats and stuff in the holidays as well?
You know, we had a very specific, Christmas when I would stay here, we would do a lasagna. We would do either a ham or a prime rib because we would do the turkey for Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
So that was kind of the California Christmas menu. Although speaking of prime rib, I did convert a vegetarian on Christmas one year, Michelle's sister.
Oh no, really?
Oh yeah. Many years, maybe 6-7 years she'd been a vegetarian and we cooked a nice prime rib and I always would make, you know, bring her something that wasn't meat based. I think we had stuffed shells or something for her. But anyway, cooked this prime rib and it was spot on, as our British friends say. It was absolutely perfect crust, smell. So I'm slicing the prime rib and she's watching. She has her, whatever they were, broccoli stuffed shells on the plate. She's kind of slowly walking by where I'm cutting and I'm putting these just rosy red, glistening, juicy slabs of prime rib on people's plates. And she's watching one go by and another go by. I see her put her plate down and she walks over, grabs an empty plate, walks up and says, blanket. She didn't say blank. She said a bad word. And then there's that few seconds where you're like, is she kidding? I don't want to.
Right.
You got me. She's like, I want a piece. So I cut her off, a vegetarian slice. You can't just not eat meat for 7 years and expect a full portion. You're lucky you're getting any.
Yeah, well, so we didn't budget for you.
We didn't. Yeah, well, actually, I did. But anyway, so I cut this thin, not too thin, but thin enough to make a point. Slice, put it on her plate, and she ate that prime rib like you've never seen anyone eat prime rib. There were groans, there were moans. And from that day on till this day, and this is at least 20-something years ago, she's a devout carnivore, omnivore technically, but really enjoys the meat. And so I have a certified notch on my chef belt of a full-blown certified with witnesses vegetarian conversion.
Wow. That's intense.
My favorite part of that story was the 3 or 4 minutes of looking at it with her plate of non-prime rib as I was finishing off slicing for the rest of the family. And then when she set her plate down and picked up the empty one and walked over, I was like, hey, what's happening here? And then it was expletive. It got me a slice.
So, John, what did we learn today?
Well, you know, today I'm trying to think, did we learn anything? Oh, yeah, we did. If you're traveling and you got room in your luggage, throw in a couple of utensils. Maybe a knife or two, some tongs, whisk, probe thermometer, just in case.
And just make sure that you check your luggage.
Yeah, and also don't judge the folks you're visiting's arsenal of culinary hand tools because they might like them. They might be used to them and to each his own. We also learned that if someone's related to you, they might be getting tickets for Christmas,
mm-hmm.
which is always a nice thing, especially if it's a ball game. I would go to that.
Is that a hint, John?
We also learned that I really, really, really like sausage on Christmas Eve, especially my Uncle Bill's. And if you're offered a voucher or a credit or just some cold hard cash to take another flight and see your family the next day, you might want to think about doing that. They very well may be fine with your decision to take the money and just see them 24 hours later.
Yes, or not.
Or not. Actually, don't take the money. Go see your family. Life's too short.
Do a Chef John and go see your family.
That's right.
So we've talked a little bit about gift giving. We have a little bit of time left to get that last minute shopping done. The gift that you, as our audience, can give to us is the same gift we always ask for, is come and leave a comment and a 5-star review on our podcast so that we can continue to bring you this outstanding content.
I was thinking cash, but that works. That's not a bad idea. That would make a lovely gift. We certainly would appreciate that. And thank you all for the support this year as we head into the end of the year and the holidays. Yeah, that's it. Say goodnight, Andrew.
Goodnight, Andrew. And happy holidays.